This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Habakkuk. Now here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Habakkuk chapter 1 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
In the summer of 1939, American preacher Donald Gray Barnhouse took his family to the coast of France on vacation. The family photos that Barnhouse took on the beaches of Normandy were later used by the Allies to plan the D-Day invasion. You see, a war was brewing in Europe. No one knew how far Hitler would go in pursuit of his militaristic ambitions. The atmosphere was tense. People everywhere were preparing for what was next. Barnhouse left his family in France for a series of meetings in Belfast, Ireland. Already, commercial flights to England had been canceled, so he took a boat across the English Channel. All over France, he heard the bell tolling, calling men to mobilize for war. French troops were everywhere. On his way to Belfast, Barnhouse learned by radio that Germany had just invaded Poland. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain had given Hitler an ultimatum. He had until 11 a.m. that Sunday, or England would declare war on Germany. Well, Barnhouse arrived in Belfast late Saturday night, just in time for the Sunday services the next day. The last words that his host pastor said to him before leaving him that night were these. He said, "I do hope you will have a good sermon. It may be the last some of the men will ever hear." Talk about preaching under pressure. That was definitely it. Well, the next day, the sanctuary was packed. Everyone was eager to hear from God in a time of such crisis. The congregation was singing hymns when one of the elders walked onto the platform and he slipped Barnhouse a note which read, "No reply from Hitler. The Prime Minister has declared war." Seconds later, the guest speaker that day was introduced, and Donald Gray Barnhouse walked to the pulpit. Here was his text, Matthew chapter 24, verse 6, which reads, "Ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled." He began his sermon listing the horrors of war. And after every gloomy description that he uttered, he said these words, "Don't be troubled." It sounded something like this. "Millions of homes will be broken up. Don't be troubled. Children will be torn from their mothers. Husbands and brothers will perish in battle. Don't be troubled. Innocent blood will flow like a river. Children will be left orphans. Don't be troubled." As the tension mounted, the preacher turned his eyes towards God and he shouted, "Don't be troubled." And then he told the church, "These words are either the words of a madman or God. How can they be spoken to men who have hearts that can weep and bowels that can be gripped with compassion? Unless Jesus is God, he has no right to tell us, 'Don't be troubled.'" Of course, then Barnhouse went on to explain that Jesus is God, that he is the God of history, that he is in charge of every circumstance, that all that happens in our world flows through a channel that has been dug by God. Though man's sin causes him to act like a savage beast at times, attacking and devouring his fellow man, even in the midst of man's insanity, God still controls history. He hasn't fallen asleep at the helm. He is awake on the bridge. He sees the future and he is in control of events no matter how terrible. And this is the message of Habakkuk's prophecy. For even in the midst of calamity and tragedy and uncertainty and confusion, our God is still in control. God's people are not to let the momentary pandemonium rob them of God's eternal peace. "The just," that is the child of God, "shall live by faith." The torch that guides us through the darkness of the unknown and the unseen is the light of faith. When life gets confusing, we're to walk by faith, not by sight. This is the message of Habakkuk. The prophet Habakkuk begins his prophecy in verse 1. The burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. Now Habakkuk lived at the end of the 7th century BC. He was a contemporary of King Josiah and of the prophet Jeremiah. He also may have known Daniel and Ezekiel. There is a legend that relates to Habakkuk. It's found in the Jewish Apocrypha. It's a group of extra-biblical writings. It's not inspired scripture, but it's interesting nonetheless. The story goes, Habakkuk was taking dinner to workers out in the fields. Suddenly, an angel appeared, and he told him that Daniel was in the lion's den in Babylon. The angel then grabbed Habakkuk by the hair and flew him to Babylon, where he fed his food to Daniel in the midst of the lions. Daniel thanked God for the meal, and Habakkuk boarded the return flight back to Judea. If it's true, it was one hair-raising experience, that's for sure. The facts are, we know nothing of Habakkuk other than the little that we glean from his prophecy here. Apparently, he was a priest. He was also a prophet. He was also a musician, we'll find later, a songwriter who loved to worship God. Habakkuk was certainly a devout man. He was concerned about the nation of Judah's declining morals. He was knowledgeable of God's justice and righteousness. And Habakkuk was a thinker. He was aware of world events. He knew what was going on around him, and he thought through these issues. Most importantly, Habakkuk was a deeply spiritual man. He desired to know God's plan and God's purposes. And Habakkuk certainly knew how to pray and to wait on God. He was a man of prayer. Here was a man who lived in crisis times, and God taught him some extremely valuable lessons. Here's an outline for this brief book. In chapter 1, we find Habakkuk wondering and then wrestling. In chapter 2, we see him watching and waiting. And in chapter 3, Habakkuk is worshiping and witnessing. In chapter 1, he begins in a valley. In chapter 2, he climbs into the tower. And in chapter 3, he ascends to the mountain. In chapter 1, he sighs. In chapter 2, he seeks. And in chapter 3, he sings. Habakkuk's prophecy begins with a sob, but it ends with a song. The prophecy of Habakkuk is for all who have struggled with the presence of evil in this world and asked the question, why? Verse 2. O Lord, how long shall I cry? And you will not hear, even cry out to you violence, and you will not save. The Hebrew word translated cry here means to roar or to scream. Habakkuk is so disturbed over the evil he sees. He's made the startling discovery that life isn't always fair. Injustice and inequity has slapped him between the eyes. He feels helpless to change these things. And what adds to his misery is he wonders why God doesn't do anything to restore order. When is God going to punish the wicked and deliver the righteous? This is what's on his mind. Verse 3. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Habakkuk is asking God, why do you reveal this wickedness to me? I can't change it, and you won't change it. Why are you tormenting me like this? He says, therefore, the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore perverse judgment proceeds. Habakkuk is describing the justice system of his day that no longer protects the innocent. He's saying that the courts in Jerusalem place a greater emphasis on a criminal's rights than on the victim's rights. Lawbreakers are being caught, he says, but there were so many loopholes. There's so much corruption in the system. There's so many weak-kneed judges that the criminals don't stay off the streets for long. The judicial system in Habakkuk's day was broken. And I suppose many would say ours in America today is too. Notice the ironical phrases in verse 4. Justice never goes forth, but judgments proceed. I mean, the courts are active, but we never get justice. Have you ever thought the same? The courts were full. The judges and lawyers and clerks were all busy. But why was it justice never got served? You know, in the world today, America has about 5% of the world's population, but 95% of the world's lawyers. Wonder what we did to deserve that. 5% of the population, 95% of the lawyers. Frivolous, unscrupulous lawsuits overload our legal dockets. The wicked and the greedy Jews of Habakkuk's day were using the courts to pad their pockets, to further their agendas. In essence, Habakkuk is saying, the righteous are outnumbered, we're surrounded. But the real question behind his legal observations was a theological one. Evil people abound. And why isn't God doing something about it? That was the big question. Where is God in these wicked days? It's Habakkuk's question. And that obviously is a question we could ask today. God responds to Habakkuk in verse 5. Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded. For I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told you. Habakkuk had accused God of not doing anything about the evil in the land. Instead, God says, not so. I'm working even as we speak. In fact, my plan is going to blow your mind. When you see what I've got planned, it's going to knock your socks off. You'll be utterly astounded when you see what I intend to do. Habakkuk had assumed that God was inactive, but to the contrary, God was at work in ways that Habakkuk had never dreamed. And this is often the case with us. We get such tunnel vision. We zero in on one way to do things. We draw broad conclusions from our narrow experiences. Whereas God, he thinks outside the box. He's working. He's dealing in ways that we don't understand. You've heard the expression, it's a jungle out there. You ever heard that expression? Of course you have. And indeed it is. At times, life is like a journey through a thick jungle brush. You're whacking with your machete, clearing a path, moving forward one step at a time. You can't see more than a couple of feet in front of you. You're wondering if the guide you're following really knows where he's going. Well, for the Christian, God is our guide. And he knows exactly where we're going and what he's doing. From his vantage point, there's no panic, there's no problem. If you're following him, you're precisely on course. You might be plowing through that jungle, but God is at work up ahead. He's making provisions that you don't even know about. You don't even know you're going to need. All you can see is the leaf in your face. All you can see is what's right there at your feet. But just around the corner, God has already hung a bridge across the raging river. Or he's built a shelter to protect you from the wild animals. Or he's prepared for you a table of delicious fruit. God is already answering prayers that you've yet to pray. His hand is at work, even though to us it's invisible. Well, God tells Habakkuk in the next few verses exactly what he plans to do to judge the evil about which the prophet is so frustrated. When Habakkuk voiced his complaint, God's plan was already in motion. Verse 6, for indeed I am raising up the Chaldeans, or Babylonians, a bitter and hasty nation which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. They all come for violence. Their faces are like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, for they heap up earthen mounds and sees it. The Assyrians were the dominant world empire. Not the Chaldeans. The Assyrians were the dominant world empire. And they had been for some 250 years. When Habakkuk writes, the middle of the 7th century BC, Assyria was actually at its zenith. The Assyrian empire was as strong as it would ever be. There was no reason for Habakkuk to suspect a change in global politics. Yet the Lord tells Habakkuk to hold on to his hat, for the mighty Assyrian empire is about to go down, and the upstart Chaldeans or Babylonians will rise to power. And that is exactly what happened. History records it. Babylon did conquer Assyria in 612 BC, then defeated Egypt at the Battle of Carchemish in 605 BC. You see, here's God's plan. He's going to bring this band of Babylonian warriors and their king Nebuchadnezzar to power to judge the evil in Judah and to address the prophet's complaint. Verse 11 continues God's prediction of this future Babylonian kingdom. Then his mind changes and he transgresses. He commits offense, describing this power to his God. After spending the last several weeks in Daniel, we know the story of Nebuchadnezzar. He was a mighty king. He was chosen. He was actually used by God. Here, this king, you remember Nebuchadnezzar was called the tool of Yahweh. But he all let it go to his head. Nebuchadnezzar got proud. He got the big head. You remember in the king's vision that Daniel had interpreted, Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. But he wasn't content with being the head of gold. For when he raised up an image in the plain of Dura, guess what? It was solid gold. In other words, he wanted greater than God intended. He didn't want to just be the head. He wanted to be the entire image. He wanted his kingdom to be one that would rule forever. You recall in Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, we're told that Nebuchadnezzar one night, he took a walk out on the balcony of his palace. He was looking out over the city of Babylon, and he said to himself, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" And God must have been eavesdropping in as he talked to himself. And God was offended by his pride, for God was the one that had raised him up. God brought madness upon the king, drove him crazy. He had a temporary bout of insanity. Nebuchadnezzar was humbled. He was brought to his knees. You remember he was led out into the fields. He roamed like a wolf, you know, for a number of years. The God of Daniel made Nebuchadnezzar successful, and yet the king had taken the credit. God had risen him up and made him victorious, but he had elevated himself with pride, and God knows how to humble the proud. Never forget that. God knows how to humble the proud. But here's what happens to Habakkuk. It's interesting. God's explanation here raises more questions in Habakkuk's head than it really answers. For Habakkuk now asks God in verse 12, "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have appointed them for judgment. O rock, you have marked them for correction." Habakkuk understands that God is going to judge Judah's sin. He thinks that's a good thing. It needs to be done. God has marked Judah for correction. But, he says, "You are of purer eyes than to behold evil, and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he?" Now, this is what Habakkuk just can't get. Why would God judge the Jews at the hands of a people like the Babylonians who were more wicked than the people that were being judged? See his problem? Yes, the Jews had declined morally. Yet compared to these idolatrous, barbaric Babylonians, They were still choir boys. Habakkuk is thinking, God, you might be at work, but what you're doing now just doesn't make sense. In the beginning, Habakkuk wondered. He wondered why God seemed inactive, and he discovered that God wasn't inactive. God was at work. But now he wrestles. Habakkuk wrestles with why God seems so inconsistent and why he would use such a wicked heathen nation like the Babylonians to judge his chosen people, Judah. Verse 14. Why do you make men like fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them? In Habakkuk's mind, it's as if history has gone berserk. He's wrestling with what he sees as inconsistencies. I know there is this holy, righteous God. I know he's behind the scenes. I know he's calling the shots. But this is not the way I imagine him to work. Have you ever thought the same? Of course you have. It looks like to me, from the way history is unfolding, that circumstances are occurring randomly, that nothing is making much sense. Henry Ford said the same thing as Habakkuk, but just in three words. He said, history is bunk. That's what Habakkuk is suggesting here. He's wrestling with the rhyme and reason of history. Is it bunk? Or is God truly in control? I'm sure you've heard the play on words. History is his story. Well, is that really true? Or is history just an unguided chain of random events and accidents? Verse 15. They take up all of them with a hook. They catch them in their net and gather them in their dragnet. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their dragnet, because by them they share their sumptuous and their food plentifully. Shall they therefore empty their net and continue to slay nations without pity? Again, Habakkuk is moaning the Babylonians. Is it right for them to prey on nations like a fisherman goes out and catches fish? They get hungry, and so they catch a few fish, then they thank their false gods for it and have a sumptuous meal, then only to get hungry again and go back for more and create more battles and more warfare and so on. Is this the way it really works, he's asking? See, Habakkuk is thinking, it's just not like God for him to allow a wicked, proud nation like the Babylonians to devour another more righteous nation like Judah. At the end of chapter 1, we've got a prophet who is perplexed. He's trying to square what he sees God do with who he knows God to be. And sometimes that can be tough. At times, God works in ways that are mysterious to us. And so here's what he does, chapter 2. I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. What do you do when God doesn't make sense? When life goes haywire, when all your conclusions end in confusions, when you can't reconcile horrible circumstances with the hands of a loving God, what do you do? Do you abandon what you know of God and start jumping to the wrong conclusions? Or do you seek the Lord? Do you seek after the Lord?
The voice you heard was that of Sandy Adams, our pastor and teacher, here on Sandy Adams Radio. Currently, he's been in a series titled Minor Prophets. Can I ask you a question? What is one of the first things you do in the morning? Do you get a cup of coffee? Do you brush your teeth or grab the nearest pen to start a to-do list for the day? Whatever you find yourself doing, nothing is more important than having a morning conversation with God. Many of us may find ourselves skipping over this invaluable time, and you wonder what words you might be missing from God. He speaks in a variety of ways. When he does, it's worth paying attention to. For example, the people of Israel and surrounding nations heard from God through the prophets like Jonah and Nahum and others. These minor prophets talked about a life of obedience to God, denying selfish desires and moving beyond the words, "I'm sorry." If you're truly remorseful over an action, will you intentionally do it again? No. By God's grace and help, that sin would be far removed from your life and from your mind. Did today's message heighten your appetite to hear more? We hope so. Go to sandyadams.org to satisfy that craving. Just click on the Teachings tab to get started. That website again is sandyadams.org. It's been a pleasure to spend some time with you today. Come back again for more on Sandy Adams Radio.